Good to see all your faces. Thanks for attending tonight. I sure do appreciate that. It's good to see some remnants left from Easter. That's nice to see that it's not all completely gone yet. Easter is 50 days long. It's not just one day. And it's also good to know that there are people, when I leave, that are here to keep things going. And I couldn't name all the names that I would need to, but the name I certainly want to mention tonight is Dave Stone, and taking the pulpit here last week and continuing our study through the book of Matthew. So I sure appreciate that. He went through the parable of the sower, which you'll see at the head of Matthew 13. And then he also looked at Jesus' explanation of that parable that's later in the chapter. What he didn't cover, and it's good for me, is he did not cover the questions that disciples ask beginning in verse 10. And it's that question that I'd like to wrestle with you tonight. It's the question the disciples ask Jesus: why do you speak in parables? Because all of a sudden he's changed his modus operandi. He's been speaking pretty straightforwardly: be merciful as your Father's merciful, do not judge lest ye be judged, and other ways that he spoke in the Sermon on the Mount. But all of a sudden in Matthew 13, there is a twist, and from this point on, his predominant means of teaching, his way to teach, is to teach through stories. Stories that, if you don't put much effort into, seem pretty plain and unimpressive. If you think about the story that David went over with you last week, a farmer who's extravagant throws seed everywhere. I mean, he just tosses it everywhere. He's not a good farmer at all. He doesn't put it in just the good soil. It lands on the path. It lands on some thorns. But in his extravagance and his ineffectiveness, somehow there is a fruitful harvest that comes in. So the point of the story is not to teach farming techniques by any stretch of the means. It's not even to talk about different types of soil as much as it's to talk about a mystery that's contained in the story. A mystery referring to the kingdom, which he highlights in verse 19, when anyone hears the message about the kingdom. And what we're going to find before we're done is most of these parables, if not all, are parables that are sacraments. They have contained within them, underneath the surface, a truth. But it's a truth you have to dig for. It's a truth that's not quite on the surface. And if you don't do the digging, the truth remains hidden from you. If you are willing to do some digging, the truth is there, but you really have to put some work into it. But these are all stories, and Jesus becomes a storyteller, and maybe you've been guilty of this, I know I have, of saying things like, you know, it's just a story. It's only a story, as if story means it's just a story, so it's not true at all, it's not fact. If we want to talk about what's really true, let's talk about abstract universals, axioms, philosophical statements, statements that have to do with quote-unquote universal absolutes, or facts or statements. And we tend to write off stories as not being true, as if somehow fiction holds no truth within it. But what I want to challenge you with tonight, particularly in light of Jesus' parables, is that's a flippant response. It's a response I try not to make anymore, because stories have a wondrous and a dangerous power. Stories may well indeed be the most powerful means of transformation that we have at our disposal. Because the opposite of truth is not fiction. The opposite of truth is falsehood. If it's not true, it's false. But much truth can be communicated through fiction, through stories. Stories that aren't necessarily stories that happened, but stories that a storyteller tells in order to evoke or provoke a certain response. So there's such a great value in fiction. That's why we have an imagination. God gave us that, and creativity and ability to learn from stories. That's why most of you will go home and you won't watch a documentary, you won't watch a scientific presentation, you'll watch a drama. Or you watch a movie that's a story about certain characters. Or if you read tonight, I doubt many of you are going to pull out the latest philosophical tome or science manual. You're going to pull out a novel. And when you go to bed to dream, whether you want to or not, your brain is going to create a story from the insanity of images that come into your mind. It's going to try to somehow put a narrative on it, to make a story of whatever is going through your head, depending on what you ate or didn't eat and other such factors. But we are people shaped by stories. Stories have power, and that's why he gave us stories. That's why Jesus tells stories of farmers and builders and shepherds and fishermen and fathers and sons and brides and maids and weddings and trees and talents and treasures and sheep and goats and leaven and seeds, and I could go on and on. But he tells stories about all these different things, and we're familiar with some of them. The ones that are most popular, parable of the prodigal son, for example, or parable of the lost sheep, or the parable of the good Samaritan. We're familiar with these stories, but he has so many other stories to offer us, and sometimes we don't quite even see what those familiar stories are about because they're just a little bit too familiar. So we have a deliberate shift in Jesus' teaching style. He's moving from the straightforward, don't do this, don't do that, love one another, into the realm of containing truth within the body of a story. And that's why his disciples in verse 10 come to him and ask, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" Well, in order to really wrestle with this, we need to know what parable means. The Hebrew for parable is mashal, the Greek for parable is paraboli. And the word actually means riddle. It can mean story, but in that idea of story, it's not a straightforward narrative. It is that there's a riddle, there's a puzzle, and you need a code to crack it. You need to put some effort into thinking about the meaning. It's a little bit different than a fable. If you ever read Aesop's Fables, what makes Aesop's Fables fables rather than the parables, although they share a lot of similarities, is Aesop likes to use animals. And he'll use fantastical creatures to do the same thing Jesus does, but Jesus doesn't use those. He uses ordinary people in ordinary situations. In fact, so ordinary that some of his parables get lost on a modern person because they're not really that dramatic. They're not that elaborate. They're not that exciting, some of them, because they're just so common and ordinary and mundane. So the challenge is to wrestle with these riddles, these stories that come to us, and the challenge, of course, is to think, what exactly are they for us? And the best definition I've ever seen, and I've added to the definition, is a parable is a simple story from everyday life, that I'm fine with, illustrating, which I'm a little uncomfortable with, a spiritual truth. Now let's stick with the definition, a simple story from everyday life illustrating a spiritual truth. The problem I have with illustrating, and you'll see it before we're done, is that gives the idea that it's the truth that matters and the story really doesn't matter. The story's just shedding light on the truth. I'd rather say, since these are riddles and puzzles, that the simple story contains the truth. That the simple story conceals the truth. It hides it like a hidden treasure. So you've got to do some digging. And so if you view them that way, you realize that the parables aren't illustrating a truth, so we can reduce them to just another principle. Well, this is just about how you love your neighbor. But we understand that they are far more powerful in what they're calling us to, so much more than just simply reducing it to a simple axiom. You know, Jesus could have spent the rest of his ministry repeating things like, "Be merciful as your Father is merciful," or he could tell the parable of the prodigal son, which shows the mercy of the Father, but so much more. He could have said, "Love your neighbor, love your enemy," but he tells this story about a good Samaritan that throws all of those categories out of the room. He could have said, "Be persistent in prayer," but he tells a parable of a nagging widow who just won't let a justice go by and another person that just needs some bread, and there's this constant pressuring. He could have said, "You know, God wants to seek you and love you and has exerted every energy to draw you to God's self," or he could tell the parable of the lost sheep. And all of a sudden you begin to see these stories aren't just illustrating these truths, because Jesus could have said these things again and again. They are meant to contain a truth. They are meant to be stories that shape our story. They're meant to be stories that shape our understanding of who we are, who God is, what God's kingdom is like, and how we are to live within this mystery called the kingdom, which is hidden in our world, concealed, and yet revealed to those willing to look for it. It's there for those with eyes that by grace can see, and ears by grace have been opened. But that same reality lies concealed for those who don't look for it. And so we got the idea between of what parables are. The question, and the question the disciples are asking, is why parables? And of course the answer is not just to illustrate truth, and it's not just to be practical. I've already given you my two key words that I think of with parables, and that is these parables are meant to reveal and to conceal. So, if you're an outsider, if you're someone like Jesus has dealt with in chapter 12, you remember all the resistance he's encountering, all the Pharisees saying, your power, you certainly can do miracles, but it's obviously of the devil. So that he's dealing with people who are seeing everything, but they don't really want to see. So he starts to use these parables because for those who don't want to see, that have their eyes closed and ears stopped, that would rather be blind and deaf to the kingdom in Jesus than to actually see God's kingdom coming in Jesus, they're not going to be able to understand what Jesus is saying. They're going to hear just silly stories. But for the disciples, whom Jesus in this shift is now moving in his master class for disciples to address them particularly. The outsiders are going to remain in the dark. Jesus understands that. They don't want to hear or see anyway. But the insiders now will have to put some effort into understanding in order to take these stories and allow them to shape their understanding of God and of the kingdom and the way they are to live. So there's a certain amount of effort. And so when they ask, why do you speak? Jesus says in verse 11, he replied, the knowledge of the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them. Whoever has will be given more, and he will have abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. So that if you're blind and deaf to seeing the kingdom in Christ, and many in Jesus' time are, his powers of the devil, for example, then you're not going to see and hear the mysteries of the kingdom in these stories. But if you're following Jesus like the disciples are, you're supposed to hear these stories and understand there's a deep truth contained in them. There is the way of the kingdom lurking or hidden as a treasure in these stories. And if we want to understand that kingdom and our role in it, we need to dig deep into these stories and allow them to shape our own sense of who we are. So we need to read these stories, not for the surface, but dig below them for the spiritual truth contained. So, for example, the parable of the talents, which this picture is supposed to represent. One man was given five talents, one given three, one given one talent. He went and buried it. You guys know that one, probably. Far too often, people, particularly if they're head deep in thinking that, you know, the scriptures are all about money, you'll hear people say, you know, there's more about money in the scriptures than anything else. Well, that's because many of the parables are about money, but the parables aren't about money. Sorry about that. They're not about money. The parable of the talents isn't about investing your money. It's about something deeper, something more that has to do with the kingdom. So when we read these parables, we have to go below the surface and not just stay there, or we'll miss the meaning altogether. Similarly, when we read stories that are historical narrative or stories of Jesus, we can't read these like parables. So when Jesus calms the storm, for example, in the Gospels, we can't read that like, oh, the deep truth is Jesus calms the storms in my life. Well, that's reading that like a parable. The deep truth is Jesus is the Messiah. He's the King. He's the Lord over heaven and earth, and the wind and the seas and the earth is at His whim. So that's what we're seeing there, something about Jesus, not some parabolic truth that we're so supposed to kind of yank out of there as if it's just a parable. We shuffle these two things way too much, and we need to learn how to read parables as parables and not read the historical stories as parables. So how do we go about interpreting these things? The challenge of parables all reduces down to one word, and I wish I'd used a different word, because nobody uses this word. They're polyvalent. If you want another word, but it's just as weird, multifaceted, but I think you get the point. A diamond's multifaceted, which means there's one diamond, there's one shine, but boy, approached from different angles, you see the beauty and the brilliance in different ways. Polyvalent means it has many uses, and the idea is that there's many ways you could approach this, because that's how the best stories work. The worst stories that I don't like when I'm preached to and there's only one meaning. If I want to be preached to, I'll come to church. But if I want to be preached, I'm not going to watch a movie because I want the movie to allow me to relate in such a way that I see numerous angles and I understand different perspectives. And it's not just meant to kind of force one idea down me, but to allow me to relate with different characters, understand different motivations, understand myself better as I understand what they do. And I ask myself, would I do what they do? Particularly when it comes to the character or characters I identify with. So that all stories initially give the interpreter the challenge of being polyvalent, of being multifaceted, of opening themselves up to many interpretations. Now, not any interpretation. You know, you can watch a story and it can mean some things, but it can't mean everything. Then it's really pointless. It has no use. But it usually has a cluster, to use a good word, a cluster of meanings. Let me give you a couple of examples. You'll see exactly what I'm saying. Does anybody watch the Goldbergs here? This is almost the last show. It's on Wednesday nights. We tape it. I go home. It's the last show. One of the last shows. Is Adam here tonight? Where's my son Adam? Hi, Adam. It's one of the last shows we watch together as a family, meaning all of us watch it. Adam and the boys and I still watch The Flash and other shows together, but my daughter's just completely abandoned the superhero thing, and I failed as a parent. I totally own that. That's all right. I'll keep those two. You better stay true, Adam. We watch The Goldbergs. It's the only show, one of the few, that we watch together as a family. I love The Goldbergs. If you watch The Wonder Years, it's Wonder Years for the 80s with a little bit more craziness. Wonder Years was a little bit more serious. This is a little bit more extreme and crazy. Well, in this story, and if you don't watch it, this is the best mom on TV. Does anyone watch this? Only you guys watch The Go. Isn't she the best mom on TV? She's the greatest mom on TV. She's a smothering mother to no end. I mean, the typical smothering mother that she'd be in the dictionary. She's so smothering. But she's so good-hearted. She's just a Beverly's her name. Well, the recent episode called Thanksgiving, this is, takes place in the 80s. The youngest son, who happens to be named Adam, he knows that the meaning in his mind of Cats in the Cradle, if you've ever heard that song. And I hope most of you have, The Cats in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon. It seems to be about, although it doesn't hit you over the head with it, it seems to be about the fact that family time's important and it slips away easily and the father tends to neglect his son in the first verse and by the end of the song, the son doesn't have time for his father. Every time I hear the song, I cry. Thinking about the song, I almost cry. I had a good dad, too. I don't know why. It just is, one of the greatest songs ever written. But Adam, thinking that that's the meaning that I would associate with it, uses that song to guilt his father to get what he wants. Because every time the song plays, just like in our household, his father cries. So his father hears it. He doesn't know why he cries, but he starts to cry. So Adam makes this video with images of him as a young boy, and it's the cats in the cradle, and he gives it to his dad so that his dad will be guilted into doing what Adam wants. Well, what's interesting, when they come together for Thanksgiving, you find that other relatives give the song a different interpretation. So one of the grandfathers says, the song's not about the importance of family time, it's about a loser son who won't make time to visit his old man. So that's how he's interpreted, and you can interpret it that way. One grandparent says it's the greatest revenge song ever. The dad finally makes time, and the son sticks it to the old man by being too busy. So the son is meeking out revenge to his father. So now it's not a song of family time from the father's perspective. It's the son who's being mean and meeting out revenge. The grumpiest grandfather says the song is about a dad who finally gets what he wants. He wants to be left alone. And thank God he's finally left alone. The song opens itself to all those possibilities. Because it doesn't hit you over the head. And yet it can't mean everything. It can kind of fit into any of those ways of hearing it if you actually listen to the song, and that's what we mean by polyvalent or multifaceted. I had other examples, and I just think it's fun to play with this stuff. Thelma and Louise. For some people, it's a story of female empowerment, a thrill ride escape for men. For others, it's two women who leave their responsibilities and become criminals. Both of those are true if you've seen the movie. Depends on who you identify with. Eat, Pray, Love, which is a true story about Elizabeth Gilbert, but still put in a story form. For some, it's the spiritual awakening of a woman from a dead-end life. For others, it's the self-absorbed midlife crisis of an unfaithful woman who leaves her husband for no reason. I tend to prefer the latter. And you can tell in how I present it. I am not impressed by her spiritual journey. But if you are, I'm grateful that it does something for you. Even things like Dumb and Dumber. And this drives my family and my wife particularly crazy. You can view this as a goofy comedy about losers. Or you can see it as a story of committed friendship. That's how I view it. These guys are friends. They're loyal to one another till the end. Bill and Ted is the same thing. You know, they're not goofy losers. They're committed friends. So it all depends on how you look at it. So I watch Dumb and Dumber with this sense of, man, these guys are good friends. They're beside each other no matter what. My wife watches and thinks I can't handle these losers. I mean, these guys irritate me to no end. So since parables are so polyvalent like this, the challenge for us is to realize, since it can't mean everything, but it must be reduced to kind of a cluster of what it could possibly mean, what are the factors that influence us as we approach these parables? And this is the part that most people aren't cognizant of, and I'm just inviting you to be more cognizant of this, because we come to stories sometimes blinded by our own stories, and how we, as Western individualists, think the stories should play out. And we pick the heroes and the villains based on that, and we forget that we swim in a certain cultural story or stories that influence how we approach. Not only that, not just this culture, but whatever your age is, or your gender, or your social strata class, middle class, lower class, upper class, marital status, your health, your career. All of these stories that we have in the back of our minds that often go uninspected are all coming into our reading of the parables. And let me give you the best example, and you'll see this right away. Mark Allen Powell is a great Lutheran scholar that I got to see in 2010. And he talked about this, that he had, as a Lutheran scholar, preached in all these different countries. And he said, in every country I preach to, when we come to the parable of the prodigal son, I always ask my students, why does the young man in the story end up starving in the pig pen? We know the story. You know, the son wants his inheritance from his dad. He goes off. The question he asks is, why is the young man starving in his pig pen? His American students, without hesitation, he wasted his inheritance. I mean, that's why. He didn't make good on the investment. I mean, he had all this money and he goes and squanders it. And we, as inheritors of that, probably that's our first impulse. When he asks Russian students that same question, why is the young man starving? They'll say, because there was a famine in the land. And man, when you're hungry, that changes everything. And the famine is widespread. And he's in a social situation where, you know, what am I going to eat? And that's why he's in a situation. If you ask students, and he did this in Tanzania, in Africa, why is this man starving? They'll say, well, because no one would help him. The communities abandoned him. And before you think, boy, those Russians and Tanzanians are way off, look at the story. Not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. See, the need's connected directly to the famine. So he went and hired himself out a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. All of them are in the story. We tend to read right past two reasons, as if they're not even there. And in fact, I was surprised when he taught this to me in 2010, because I do too. I thought, wow, they're all there. And they're all connected in the story as reasons why he's in the desperate situation he is. He's squandered socially, culturally. There's a famine. Community-wise, no one will help him. He's all on his own. Now, no one will help him doesn't bother us much as Western individualists, because we think you pull up your own bootstraps. It's up to you. It's not about us. It's not the common good. You lose out on life. You lose out. So we tend to pick one of the three, and the reason we pick one of the three is because of a story we tell ourselves in our culture that goes unquestioned, that we live in an individualistic, merit-based culture, where if you screw up your investments and end up on the wrong side of the track, that's your fault, buddy. Doesn't matter what the social conditions are like. It doesn't matter whether anyone is there to show mercy or kindness. It just matters that you didn't work hard. You wasted things. So that our story puts blinders on parts of the story for us, and we're not able to see the whole of what's going on. Another thing that will often influence our reading of a story is not just the social, cultural location we're in, it's who we choose to empathize with. And anyone who watches stories knows that if you ever watch a movie and you can't empathize with at least one character, you won't stick with it long. You need someone to empathize with. You need someone that you can either respect or look up to, or you can identify with. Batman movies. Sorry, I have to do this. The only way to enjoy a Batman movie is not to identify with Batman. If you think you're Batman, you're crazy. And if you think you're Batman or want to be Batman, you're crazier. He's nutso. The dude's got screws loose. He does. I know him intimately. You don't want to identify with him. And yet we tend to, because we think, I'm self-made. I do all this stuff. I get my tools, get my toys. Come on. If you want to enjoy Batman, identify with the only character you can identify with, Commissioner Gordon, who is stuck in between a situation where the crime is so rampant he needs this vigilante who's crazy, and yet trouble's going to ensue if he does, and he's just caught between a rock and a hard place, trying to do what's right, and yet having to bend the rules to do it, and yet he's committed to the rules, and he's the character to identify with, in my opinion. That'll make every Batman movie so much better for all of you. So, our empathy choice matters, and let me give you a good example from the parables, the world of the parables. You're all familiar with this one of the most popular parables in Jesus' catalog of stories, the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who do you empathize with? Now, if you're an American, we can't be Levites. We're not the priest. So who do we identify with? Who should be my neighbor? Because I'm the Good Samaritan. I'm ready to help. If you're Tanzanian, where you're much more rooted in not an individualistic culture, but a community-oriented culture, guess who you identify with? You're the helpless man. You're one that's been beaten up. You're wondering who's going to help you. And the point you get from this story is God helps us in ways we'd least expect. Now, we normally don't get that point from the story. God helps us in ways and means and through people we'd never, ever expect, because we're not thinking about being helped. We're thinking about being the helper. And who we choose to empathize with shapes how we then come to what is the truth in the story. The whole truth may be that we are both the priest and the Levite and the Samaritan sometimes, and a lot of times the helpless man broken by the side of the road. There were all those, and that's when you begin to wrestle with, boy, now we see the true polyvalence. We see the true multifaceted way of coming at these stories and wrestling with a deeper meaning that may be there, that allows us to delve into a truth of the kingdom that will allow us to see ourselves, our world, and others better. But if we're looking for the key, and this is the best key I can give you in interpreting the parables, because it's so obvious, it's like the nose on the end of your face, and once you see it, it'll never go away. Every single parable Jesus tells, I would agree with David Wenham and others who have said, every parable is about the kingdom. They're all about life in the kingdom, the way the kingdom exists in this world, the personality and nature of the king, what it's like to be kingdom people. And if you want, if that's not true, and I think it is, Matthew 13 is certainly all about the kingdom. If you look at the text with me real quick, I already showed you verse 19. When anyone hears the message of the kingdom, if you look at verse 24, Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like, if you look at verse 31, the kingdom of heaven is like, verse 33, the kingdom of heaven is like,
Verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like. Verse 45, the kingdom of heaven is like. Verse 47, the kingdom of heaven is like. These are kingdom parables. And if we miss that, we miss it all. Because at least this cluster of parables is all about the kingdom of God that has been manifest and will be manifest in and through Christ. So if we want to understand the nature of the kingdom, we need to delve into these parables, because the kingdom is a mystery. The kingdom is contained in our world, it's expressed in our world, but it's concealed if you don't want to see it. If you just want to kind of act as if the world story is it's a secular world devoid of meaning, you can view the world that way. Or you can view it as a world that is created by God, that is being redeemed by God, in which the gospel, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, is true, and you can understand that that kingdom draws near in unexpected and provocative ways. That's the true story of this world. The story of God's kingdom. God's story of God's reign. The story that Jesus believed so much, he went to a cross believing that God's kingdom will stand no matter what. So we begin to see that if we're going to get at the heart of the parables, they're all about the kingdom. What it's like in this world, even with its current evil. That's why I wanted to save the parable of the weeds, beginning in verse 24, for next week. There's no better parable about understanding how God's kingdom is real, and yet evil still continues to exist, and what we're to do about that evil, or not do. Just wait. It is a very important parable for us to understand who it is, what it is to be kingdom people, what the kingdom's life, what God's character is like, what God expects from us, and what God does not want us to do in trying to establish God's kingdom. So it's a very important parable. It deserves its own sermon, and that's why I've saved that for next week and just wanted to introduce you to the point of parables this week. So with that in mind, let me kind of wrap this up by concluding with where I started, and that is that there is a deep power in story. I argued at the beginning that the most powerful means of transformation known to humankind is story. The stories have this wondrous and dangerous power. And the reason I believe that is because the gospel's a story. We're studying the story of Jesus Christ, the gospel, the good news, the story of the Christ. It is his story that we are entering into in order to understand God's story and to understand our story in light of God's story. So to say it's only a story, it's just a story, undermines the very thing we hold most precious, the gospels themselves, not just the parables. We need to recognize that at the end of the day, truth, as we know it, is storied. Stories don't just illustrate truth, they are truth. You are the story you tell yourself about yourself. When people ask us to describe ourselves, we tell the stories that have shaped us. We tell the stories of what we hope for. We enter into this because story is more powerful than just simply abstract propositions. Now, as children of the Enlightenment, we tend to equate truth with proposition and abstract and universal and absolute. All those things we really don't touch. We really don't interact with. I don't interact with abstract propositions. I don't interact with universal absolutes. You know what I interact with? The stories I've experienced. And there's truth in those that are far more personal and particular and concrete and, most importantly, relational. I would argue that stories are real and stories are how we experience truth. And the reason we're drawn to novels and to movies is because truth as we experience it is far more like the stories we hear than it is the philosophy manuals we read and the scientific text that we entertain. That it has far more to do with love, life, laughter, joy, despair, sadness, sorrow, courage, things that we wrestle with together. And it is those things that shape us, things that we read about in the parables, these everyday life graces that really can change our lives in very, very prominent ways. At the end of the day, isn't it true that we're trying to be gospel people? That we have a story to tell to the nations? That we want to be shaped by a story? That we want to understand that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son? That's a story. The story of the Christ who's given, who comes. And it's that story that is meant to shape us. That's why this book is not just an encyclopedia of facts. That's why it's not just a bunch of philosophical axioms for us. If you want that, there are other religions that go that route. This doesn't. From beginning to end, it's a story. Even the epistles are letters written to churches caught up in their own story. The Psalms and Proverbs are meant to influence the story of your life and to shape the worship and praise of your life. So with all that said, let me come back to our text to wrap this up, because there's a wonderful thing Jesus says at the end of His explanation for why He tells parables. He's already told us that people see but don't see, hear they don't hear, so He's going to conceal the truth in these things called parables. But in verse 16 He says, "But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For I tell you the truth, many prophets and righteous men longed to see what you see but did not see it, and to hear what you hear but did not hear it." He wants them to know that what they have been given is a grace gift. That they've been caught up in the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ in such a way that the Spirit, by God's grace, has opened their eyes and opened their ears. That they didn't kind of work their way to this enlightenment, but that God has blessed them with this. That the blessing is grace has opened their eyes and ears to wonders and treasures that many don't see. Which is not a reason to undermine those who do not see. It is a reason to be grateful that you do, and a reason to tread forward in trying to see as best you can, and to hear as clearly as possible. Because when we see and hear as clearly as possible, it not only benefits us, but it benefits the whole world. Even those who don't see, and those who don't hear. That there's meant to be this wonderful influence. And so Jesus gives us stories to make the mysteries of the kingdom plain to us, mysteries that are hidden within these parables. The question is, will we make the effort to listen? Will we delve into the stories and find the treasure? And will they shape our story in such a way that we can say, "This is my story, this is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. We have a story to tell to the nations." Will it do that? Or will we get just hung up on axioms and principles and laws and codes of conduct and forget that we are story people, we are gospel people, we are good news of great joy people. And we are so full of joy because we've been graced with eyes and ears that are able to hear and to see something that is such a treasure. There's no greater treasure to fathom.